When a farm has been in the family for almost a century, the decision to sell is particularly tough. But for twin brothers Finn and Robert Lindsay Field, who have endured droughts, floods and fickle incomes, it was the year to make the move. They've sold their property, Warbrecken, on the banks of the Edward River at Deniliquin in southwest New South Wales. Warbrecken is Aboriginal for the land of big trees, and it's a wool property that's had a colourful history. It was a summer camp for the Heidelberg School of Arts, including Arthur Streeton, and was owned at one point by a former Premier of New South Wales. Our reporter Larissa Smith caught up with the Lindsay Field brothers at the homestead as they reminisced about the station's colourful past.
Well, Phillips and Graves, they virtually turned up here in 1845. They virtually sold on to quite a few different owners along the way. One of the main owners was Sir Patrick Jennings. He was Premier of New South Wales and had a lot to do with the politics in the early part of, or the late part of last century. The Jennings side virtually also encouraged visitors from, political visitors from worldwide to come here and stay at Warbrecken. And that's where the bit of royalty came along and stayed different nights. McCulloch and Co., which was the river traders of Echuca and the Murray system, they virtually owned the property for quite some years until the homestead burnt down in 1896. The property was then sold to us in 1918. LKS McKinnon Stakes, the man who'd waited Farlap, he was a partner with our grandfather in 1918, and then they had a bit of a break-up in partnership, and our grandmother Daphne and Harry Lindsay Field took over the property, and at that stage it was 68,000 acres.
Robert, at its peak, how many sheep was Warbrecken running?
Back in those earlier days of our grandfather taking over, we probably ran about 40,000, I suppose, for the acreage that was left after the division with McKinnon, yes.
And so then the property was broken up post-World War II?
Our grandfather came up with an idea to split it up into lots for settlement, closer settlement. I think they were 640 blocks, acre blocks, and they grew wheat and ran fat lambs and tried to survive, but they weren't really big enough blocks in this district to have a go. So some of the blocks actually went back to the bank, and the other ones had battled on, bought out the neighbours, and after that happened, the acreage had been broken back to 17,000 acres, and our grandmother ran that until the 1960s.
When did irrigation first come to the property?
In 1956, our father and grandmother went up to Leeton and found a couple of people who had been growing rice in the Yanko district, and encouraged them to come down and gave them some land to put rice on. The irrigation had come through. We didn't understand much about growing rice, and they were encouraging people to put rice in. So they asked the Rourke family, John Rourke, Teresa to come down, and they lived out in the barracks at our old woolshed and had a family out there living in the shearing barracks. And in 56, they put their first rice crop in. It was particularly wet, and they couldn't get any mechanical harvesters onto the paddocks, so they had to use horses to harvest the rice. The government wanted rice growing to sort of make the irrigation work for the district, and we still grow rice today.
A range of characters have had a close connection to Warbrecken. Can you name a few?
Dear old Frederick York Wolseley virtually came out with Phillips and Greaves in 1845. While at Warbrecken, he came up with the concept of the overhead shearing gear and the handpiece, and also the motor car. So that was very interesting. And also another character was Arthur Streeton, who did some paintings here on the property, and his great friends of our grandmother. And McGovern also came here. So the Heidelberg School of Arts found this as a bit of a retreat. Summer camp retreat for them to enjoy the Riverina Plains and take time out.
We're standing in your house, and it's a magnificent piece of architecture. How many rooms?
We've got 27 rooms in the house. Sometimes you can recount, you might get 28, depending on what tour you're doing. But it's quite a bit of room in the loft of this house, and we always ask, get people to go and find the stairs, but they never find them. Yeah, so it's got the big billiard rooms and statuary and dining rooms and drawing rooms, and yeah, no, and it's definitely got a warm feeling about it. And Robert and I have broken our partnership after many years. I've just become a father of young Finn. This means that something has to go, and the Watson family, David and Catherine Watson, are the proud owners of Warbrecken.
How rare is it for one family to hang on to their property for almost a century.
It's very rare. We're from Tasmanian blood. We got to Tasmania in 1806 on one of those boats, interesting boats, but we did very well. I believe that that William Field was the fifth richest man in Australia there at one stage. The love of the land and the Field family, because we have been farming since 1806, 1807 in Tasmania, and we're long lasters. But it's been a struggle with droughts and floods and bad prices for livestock, and now with the water price at where it is, it's making it very difficult. To still be farming after 100 years, hopefully it could continue for the, you know, generations to come.
Finn and Robert Lindsay Field, ending that report from Larissa Smith. Now staying with history for a little bit longer and having a look at drought, despite indications that the drought affecting parts of Queensland and New South Wales is creeping further south, farmers in southern Australia are still faring much better than their counterparts from a century ago. 1914 remains one of the hottest years on record. It was also one of the driest, with drought affecting the country's east and west and leading to an almost total failure of the national wheat crop. But some of the characteristics of what helped people get through drought in the early 20th century are still making a difference in rural Australia today. Attributes like working with your neighbours, the camaraderie amongst the despair, and that unrelenting belief that things can and will get better. Kath McAloon journeyed to northeast Victoria, where she met Margaret Pullen. Her family has owned a property on the banks of beautiful Reedy Creek since 1857 and experienced all the hardship of that 1914 drought.
So see, when the water comes up high over the bank, this here is all covered with water and flows back around past those three beautiful big red gums there and then back into the creek. My name is Margaret Grossman Pullen. I was born here and I've lived most of my life here, Wangaratta. We're standing on the bank of the beautiful Reedy Creek, which really meant so much to my family since 1857, when the property was first settled by the Grossmans. It was a source of water, and it meant that the cattle could graze in the paddocks and come down to the creek for their water supplies.
100 years ago, your father was on this property and he was farming this property. He's kept diaries from the time, and it sort of details, I guess, the drought of 1914. From his diaries, what sort of impression do you get of what life was like on this land 100 years ago?
Well, I think that it was very difficult. And I guess at the time, perhaps you accepted, it's easy for us to say, well, you know, we can't cope in this situation. But 100 years ago, I don't know what else there was to compare it to, because you had the written word and you had the newspapers, but you didn't have much other communication apart from support from your neighbours. And I know that the community rallied together and they all helped each other, and that was so important in those days.
We're sort of squelching through the mud today. A 100 years ago it might have been.
It would have been bone dry.
Rebecca Jones, a historian from the Australian National University, has been studying Margaret's father Charles's diaries as part of her research into drought in southern Australia over the past 150 years.
He started farming in 1914, just at the beginning of the drought, aged only 16. His father had died the previous year and he had inherited the farm and was now the breadwinner for his mother, younger brother and sister and grandmother. His was a baptism of fire in a way. He was thrown into farming at what turned out to be one of the worst droughts that area had experienced. His wheat crop failed completely. He was able to harvest a few almonds, but the majority of his survival mechanisms was to grow his own fruit and vegetables with the help of his mother and to forage wood down at the creek. some of the wood he sold, much of the wood he just used on the farm. His income for that year was £3.
For the entire year?
For the entire year. But he was able to, he and his family were able to keep going through growing their own and foraging, bit of fish, bit of wood, bit of vegetables. There was no reports in the diary that they were short of food. They were not on death's door. In fact, they actually had a very diverse diet. Their lives were not dire, but they were certainly not comfortable either. And of course, self-sufficiency means you don't have excess money to pay for medical expenses, that kind of thing.
Does he talk of sort of despair or frustration during the drought?
It's surprising how philosophical he is, you know. He writes on the inside cover of his diary, he's written 1914 drought year, underlined very heavily. So it was a significant event for him. He doesn't write of despair. He's quite a sort of self-contained chap. He writes of the frustration. Every day, you know, he looks at the sky, few clouds waft past, no rain falls. And farmers today talk about that sheer frustration, the endless beautiful blue skies, which don't actually produce rain, that seem to sort of taunt them. Another story, it was written as a memoir. It was written by a woman called Mary Cornell, and she lived in the Mallee in northwestern Victoria. Her family moved to the Mallee a couple of years before the 1914 drought, and she recalls the quietness of the drought in 1914. No harvesting, no shouting, no clack of the machinery, no horses moving up and down the track. She said nothing was being harvested, so it was silent. They received some government assistance. Because this was a newly settled area, the government provided assistance during the drought for farmers to make improvements which would help them during the drought, the current drought, but would also have a longer-term effect in restructuring their farm. And she and her family received money to dig a bore, and they dug a bore to about 300 feet and received fresh water out of the bore. They erected a windmill to dig to pump the water out of the ground, and she describes that as her monument to drought. They looked at that windmill for many years afterwards and remembered it as something that was positive that came out of the drought for them.
Dr. Jones says while the 1914 drought was relatively short, its effects were harsh.
It's another of those very short, sharp droughts. It lasted for about, depending on the region you're in, for 15 to 18 months. Very dry weather, particularly from about April 1914 until about May 1915. In hindsight, we know now it was another El Nino drought. It led to almost total failure of the southeastern Australian wheat belt crop. They had about harvest of about a quarter of the usual harvest that they would normally have, and many, many farmers harvested absolutely nothing, not even enough to save the seed for the sowing in the next year.
Dr. Jones has been looking back on past droughts and reading old diaries of farmers from decades ago to understand how they coped with drought.
I'm really interested in what helps farmers and agricultural communities respond to drought, what helps them adapt to drought, both in the long term and in the short term. One of the things I started off thinking, I would look at the drought years, see how people coped, and you know, I would understand how people coped with drought. I've realised in reading the diaries and the diaries of farmers and doing my other research that the way people cope with drought is not just what happens in the drought years, it's what happens throughout, it's how they farm, it's what happens before, during and after the drought. And in preparing for the next one, it's the way people live their lives as much as what they do during drought that's important. One of the ways which people did survive drought then, which is really quite different to how they survive drought now, is that they were able to send their farms into what you can describe as sort of a state of dormancy. They found they either left the farm for a short period of time and found work elsewhere. They were not leaving the farm in droves permanently, but they just sort of shut the farm down, put it in mothballs, went to work elsewhere. They also used self-sufficiency in foraging a great deal in those days. Prior to the Second World War, many farms were self-sufficient in fruit, vegetables, milk. The drought meant that they were unable to produce enough for their commercial crops, but they were often able to find enough water from wells or such like to produce enough food to keep themselves going.
Are there any lessons from the past that you think farmers of today could benefit from?
Certainly accepting that drought is going to come and it'll go and it'll come again. I do think most farmers do operate on that basis, although some farmers are not able to put as much into place as they would like in order to prepare for the next drought because of their other expenses and or the conditions of their farm. I think one of the aspects of drought in the past, which is much harder to accommodate now, is that farmers are on the edge more than they were in the past. It sounds funny, doesn't it? Because you think of farmers as barely scraping a living in the past, but I think because of the huge overheads that farmers have now, the huge input expenses, many don't have that slack to accommodate periods of scarcity as well as periods of abundance, and periods of scarcity is just an inevitable part of the climate in Australia.
Dr. Rebecca Jones from the Australian National University, who is researching drought in Australia.